Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. I listen to a lot of cast recordings. I spend an hour, maybe two, with each one of them, then move on to the next. But I sometimes forget that 90-minute recording I just listened to was actually hundreds and hundreds of hours of work to get to those perfect moments I got to enjoy. The new movie, Moment to Moment, The Making of the Violet Hour Studio Cast Recording, provides that behind-the-scenes look at the process of creating the cast recording of The Violet Hour. Today, I am joined by the writing team of Will Reynolds and Eric Price, who will tell us a little bit about themselves, their show, The Violet Hour, and their new movie about the making of the cast recording. So let's welcome Will and Eric to the show. Hello, guys, and welcome.
Hi there.
Hi, great to see you.
Awesome. Now, before we get into all that fun stuff, I want to get to know you guys a little bit better. So I always ask for a 30-second bio of who you are. So, Eric, I'm going to throw you on the spot first. Who's Eric in 30 seconds?
So start the clock. I am a lyricist and a book writer, a playwright, a producer, a director, and a professor of theater. I've dedicated my entire life to theater, particularly the musical theater, and I've made that dedication every year for as long as I can remember. I was a student of directing and have a degree in directing for my undergrad work, and then my graduate degree is in musical theater writing. Then I spent many years working as the assistant to the brilliant director, producer, Hal Prince. And Hal Prince had a 21 Tony Award winning career that changed the face of our art form. And for the years I spent at his side, I learned as much as I possibly could. And now I'm able to divide my day between all of those sub-professions within the umbrella of making theater and teaching theater. And it really is the joy of my life that I was able to do exactly what I set out to do, which was to make a life and a career as a collaborator in the theater.
Very nice. Will, can you follow that up? 30 seconds. Who are you?
You got it. Yeah. So I grew up with a pretty debilitating stutter, and it still comes up every now and then. And my experience of the world as a kid growing up, as I was learning to how to express myself, is really like somebody trapped behind glass. It cost me so much to work to be actually just understood. And so I would stop trying to be understood because it was so effortful and embarrassing. But theater saved me. And I got signed up for theater classes. And we found that when I played pretend and when I got on other people's words, it completely freed up my literal anatomy and my own ability to express. And so I have really become devoted to the idea of the expansion of expression, period. I happen to enjoy doing that in theater, you know, for now and for the last, you know, however many decades I've been doing it. But it really is more of just like a like lifestyle, you know. And so whether it's my own work, my work with Eric, my teaching work, the things I share on the internet, it's just all about expanding expression, both for myself and for anyone who encounters the things I do. And so we'll talk about all of the specific things, but I like to start there because that's really like why I do what I do. And I think that's more important than the what sometimes.
Well, I'd love to take it back to the beginning. I'll start again with you, Eric. Were you always into musical theater growing up, or was that something you discovered a little bit later in life?
Not just musical theater, but any form of storytelling captivated me beyond belief. Just that feeling that a kid has when they're being told a story and they say, "What happens next? What happens next?" I wanted to live in that space. And musical theater in particular provided such a vivid form where that feeling could be experienced. And whether it began with movie musicals, particularly things like The Wizard of Oz or the Alan Menken and Howard Ashman scores for the Disney movies of the early 90s that sort of just said, this is not just an art form that is compelling, but people made this for their job. And in the future, you could be one of those people. That feeling has sustained me for decades. And then once I discovered the work of Stephen Sondheim and Hal Prince, the idea that musical theater could be an art form that was brave and dangerous and path setting was something that I just built into my aspirations, and it shaped my taste, and ultimately it shaped my life. My first job out of college was sitting between Sondheim and Prince in previews for a new musical, taking notes for both of them. And I consider my experience both rare and unbelievably lucky, but every day I try to earn that experience by what I put forth into the world, what I learned from the people I was able to work alongside, and putting those experiences into my work as a writer or my work as an educator is, it feels like the best way I can spend my days.
Will, what about yourself? As a kid growing up, were you into that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, I think tied to that, you know, the sort of expression problem I had growing up, that just with the stutter, the music first was really also a place of complete freedom and abandon, where that, where what was happening in terms of how I tried to speak totally went away. There were different rules. I was playing piano. I was able to make sounds in ways that just was free. And then when I started to understand what acting was and theater was, and then seeing there was this place that was music and this place where people were able to express themselves and get on this kind of language, it was this, you know, it was this perfect marriage of the things that were like kind of healing me, you know? And so it's not a surprise that all I wanted to do was stay in that space and be in that space. And it just sort of, and then I was like a professional actor growing up, and I started doing regional theater outside of Chicago and like national commercials and like print ads and stuff. And really since like fourth grade, I've been like, you know, making some kind of a living doing this thing. And it just was always the only path. And I think honestly, because of the, of, you know, knowing the, like what it did for me in terms of my ability to be expressed, I was like, I can't leave this place. This is my zone of, I won't even say genius, of expression, you know? And so for me, it's once I discovered it, it was like, well, I have to stay here. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, growing up, all kinds of children's theater, all kinds of, you know, anything my parents could throw me into, they would. And honestly, I have to, you know, express massive gratitude to my parents for even saying yes. You know, I know lots of other artists who didn't have that experience, right? And had folks who were like, no, you're going to be a this, like, we don't want you to do that. And so I was gratefully surrounded by an incredible support system who said yes, and teachers who said yes and pushed me forward. And then, you know, once I understood what a cast album was, and, you know, we'll talk more about these for sure, you know, that experience as a kid of just sitting on our floors, this is now both my story and Eric's, where we would sit on our floors and, you know, read, follow along with the liner notes and imagine in our mind's eye what might be going on stage as we listen to these shows. I mean, that was just, it was intoxicating. And I had to, you know, I had to just go from one show to the next, as you were saying at the top of this, you know, spending so much time with each album and trying to understand what actually went into this and what is going on there. And people made this, you know, as Eric said. And so, yeah, a very similar story.
So now I'm curious, the parallel lines of Eric and Will's life, how did they all of a sudden intercede? How did they meet?
Well, we, so I, again, for people saying yes, I wanted to go to, I was a junior in high school and was now really looking at my future and like, well, do I want to major in this thing? What is it to major in theater? Carnegie Mellon had a pre-college program. And so I had done some research, and whenever the shows would come to Chicago, I would look in the bios of where people went to school, and I sort of always kept seeing the same suspects. And so I was like, well, Carnegie Mellon's on my list. I keep seeing these amazing actors coming through who went there. They had this pre-college program over the summer, and so my parents said yes, and I went off to Pittsburgh for 6 weeks. And while I was there, I made a friend in Victoria Lightkey, who grew up with Eric, and she was always talking about her friend Eric, who had a theater company in Oklahoma, and Eric was a genius, and Eric was this brilliant director, and Eric had all these ideas, and you got to talk to Eric, you got to talk to Eric. And I'm like, all right, let me talk to Eric. And so, and so we get on the phone, and it's like, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, there's this guy who thinks, who has the same values as I do, who knows, like, I felt like I was a little walking encyclopedia of theater and the rep and just like understanding where, how things connected. And, but I'm like, this guy is way beyond what I thought I might have known about, like, you know, the writers and the shows and the producers and like how the lineage of all the things. And it was just very clear from just that one conversation. I can kind of even see in my mind's eye, like where I was in this little dorm room in Pittsburgh talking to Eric and walking around on like a wired phone. and we just stayed in touch, you know, there were, you know, we would talk, chat on AIM, you know, on AOL chat. And we would just sort of talk about theater, talk about shows, talk about Sondheim, talk about all the things we loved. There was a time where, you know, this is probably, you know, someone will come after us, I'm sure. But Eric put into the mail the full score of a musical that he had done a production of that, you know, this was also back in the day where like you couldn't like download a PDF of something, you know. And, you know, I remember arriving in my mailbox and it was like, and I got to put it on my piano. And, you know, it was like, this guy has all the things. So I don't know. We just stayed in touch, and we went through college, and then we connected in the city. And at that point, we had both really, really had come out of our training programs with real clarity of the things we wanted to say yes to and create. And we started meeting once a week at around the fountain at Lincoln Center, just talking about theater, what we'd want to make. And we very quickly started working on something, and now here we are, literally like 20 years later.
So Eric, was it? Had you worked with other, you know, composers before? Was this an easy? Did you guys find it was an easy transition to work together, or, you know?
Yeah, it always feels both easy and like arriving at home to write with Will. The shared sensibility and taste that we have, the things we agree on, and then the things that we don't agree on ultimately cause the work to be enhanced and improved in so many ways. It's a joy to collaborate. And he was both my first primary collaborator, and also in the middle of our collaboration, I went to grad school and went to NYU and collaborated with so many people. And in many ways, those experiences were hugely valuable and impactful and often very joyous, but they had the effect of setting me up to be an even better, more generous collaborator when I returned to Will at the end of that master's degree program. And I shouldn't say return to him. We were still working together throughout the entirety of my graduate school experience. And so having sort of circled the globe with collaborators and then returned home, it feels like the work we do together is the center of our creative lives. And when I was a kid, I always was looking for the name that would be on the other side of that ampersand. You look at Rodgers and Hammerstein, or Kander and Ebb, and the "and" is expressed as that really elusive, beautiful figure that is the ampersand, this curly Q of a symbol that basically implies being intertwined with someone. And I wanted to find that person all through my childhood, the name that would be waiting on the other side of that symbol of being intertwined. And I'm so lucky and grateful that my favorite composer in the world is the person on the other side of the ampersand.
Very cool. So let's talk about the show you guys wrote together, The Violet Hour. What was the impetus for it? What was the history of it?
Well, in 2003, I was working in Chicago on my first job with Hal Prince. It was a new musical called Bounce. The score was by Stephen Sondheim. The book was by John Wideman. And it was a front row seat to watch my heroes, Mount Rushmore of musical theater, make a musical right in front of me. But on my night off, I went to the Steppenwolf and saw a play by Richard Greenberg called The Violet Hour, which was making its Midwest premiere at that moment. It was on its way in a separate production to premiere in New York City the following fall. And I walked out of the theater that night and felt that this play would be an incredible musical. I had loved Richard Greenberg's work for a number of years and seeing this new work of his after really adoring his play 3 Days of Rain in the years prior made me a great fan, and I want to believe a great ideal audience member for his work. I feel that there's nothing that Richard puts on the page that in some way I'm not receiving. And The Violet Hour struck me as extraordinary. When it premiered as a play on Broadway the following year, it was dismissed with what I felt was a very hurtful set of misunderstandings about what the play and the production intended. And in many ways, the play sort of disappeared for a while. And then years later, we knocked on Richard Greenberg's door, more or less, and proposed that we could transform his play into a musical, that he agreed with that idea, that he eventually said yes and was charmed by the ideas that we presented for how that play might be enhanced and even, dare I say, improved as a musical. He was very game for. He has never allowed any of his other work to be optioned for adaptation. And we feel honored, grateful, and deeply lucky every day that he has been so supportive of our effort to take care of the brilliance of his original play, even as we transformed it into a new entity that is The Violet Hour, the musical.
So this was in what, 2003, you said?
Well, 2003 is when the play made its premiere, and then we carried the idea with us for many years, and it wasn't until the year 2018 that we had developed work that we thought would be compelling to him. We wrote another show called Radioactive, which is the story of Marie and Pierre Curie and the discovery of radium. And we used that show to sort of represent our artistic ability, our aesthetic, our taste, our style. And then we also wrote some spec material for what a musical version of The Violet Hour might be. So in 2018, in the early months of that year, he gave us permission to begin writing the show. And since that moment, virtually every day of our lives has been dedicated to one way or another, rolling that marble up the mountain to transform The Violet Hour, the play, into The Violet Hour, the musical, and create assets and eventually, we hope, a first-class production of that show.
Yeah, I think, you know, well, there's a lot of kind of sort of, you know, artistic leapfrogging that happens, you know, in the theater, especially, and, you know, or I think any kind of, you know, career, art form where it just takes a long time to get things on. It takes a long time to complete the work and get it right and revise and revise. And so, yeah, so we saw, so the play entered our world when it entered the world in 2003. And then it was just lots of conversations, thinking about it, doing lots of other writing, always sort of returning to this as an idea. But I think Eric and I both knew that we would need to have a certain level of a body of work to present to Richard, so he would feel that he was, that his play was in good hands. And so we started, you know, we had written, you know, there were a few songs that were written in, you know, 2010, 2011 for The Violet Hour that then we really hit pause on because we had this gut feeling that if we just presented these songs and sort of, you know, some other of our sort of like proto writing, I don't know if we would have made the case. You know, who knows? Maybe we would have made, maybe we wouldn't have. But I think we did have this gut feeling that we needed another full show to show him. And so we hit pause on any more development of the Violet Hour, as Eric said, went into Radioactive. And I think it was our confidence of what we did in there and what we could show him in terms of a full draft, a full demo, a sort of, you know, production history behind that and workshop development history behind that we felt really confident making that call. And and so, you know, these things, so even though Radioactive was created, you know, whole cloth before Violet Hour, you know, Violet Hour has emerged first. And, you know, there was this sort of like lovely, like leapfrogging thing that happens with projects. So, you know, I know we are not the first in musical theater history to work that way.
You hear it all the time. Like we forget that from the germ of the idea in 2003 to, you know, 2018, 15 years. What else takes 15? You've raised a child at that point and they're going to be going on. Like, it's crazy. The time it takes to write all this stuff and create it and put it together. So what is the plot of The Violet Hour?
It's set in 1919 in New York City, And it is all set largely in a single room. That room is a newly opened office for a young man who wants to be a publisher. And his first task in creating his publishing firm is to decide what book is going to be his maiden effort. He only has the resources to release one book. And so he knows that it's going to be a make or break effort. So the decision is wildly important. And he has a couple of very good candidates, and each of the authors behind the leading contenders for what book is going to be published has a unique relationship with our main character, John. Those authors often have secret or at least hidden motivations for needing to be published. And the question in Act One is largely which book is going to be chosen. But that question is really interrupted when a mysterious machine arrives at the office. And the machine is sort of like a printing press, and it begins spewing out pages, which are eventually discerned to be from books from the future, books that will be written and published in the years following 1919. The pages actually reveal what happens in our world for the next 100 years. And so our main character, John, learns what the 20th century has in store, and he learns what the first 19 years of the 21st century have in store. And once he gains the power to tell the future, not only does he learn what book he is going to publish, but he learns everything good and bad that is waiting for us in the years and decades to come. And having that information changes his thoughts on what book he might want to publish. It changes his thoughts on what he might want to do on the day that our show is set, April 1st, 1919. And in a way, the show asks, if you know what happens tomorrow, what are you going to do today? In some ways, it sort of seems like that is an impossible situation. Well, we can never know the future, so why should we care what one person who, in a fictional story, does know the future, why should we care what that person does? But of course, we do know the future. We understand the inevitabilities that are waiting around the bend and in the long run all too well. And we spend so much of our life pushing those inevitabilities to the side or fixating on them and not living in the present. In many ways, the Violet Hour is a study in how to have hope for the future, even if you know that the future is going to bring things that are both joyous but also destructive. How do you keep hope alive? Those questions and this story and the brilliant characters created by Richard Greenberg have sustained us as we've explained. For decades, we believe there is infinite life in this show. The resonance of it goes all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. We constantly find new things. That's why we've been able to write for so long and never get tired of the world that we're inhabiting. And it's why we've spent so much human resource to create assets like the studio cast album and the film that tells how that cast album was made, because we believe that at the heart of this story, there is something extraordinary and worth it, and we never get tired of exploring it.
So let's talk about the cast recording. I know you had some, difficulties because of what was going on in the world.
There was a
So
pandemic,
a little bit
yes.
of a pandemic going on. So explain, you had these songs and you wanted to record them. How did you take it to the next level, especially during the pandemic?
Yeah, well, it's funny how just things sometimes do kind of come together, and then the way that the dominoes were lined up in a way that you just can never predict. And so where we were pre-pandemic was there's a amazing new musicals incubator in Newport News, Virginia, at Christopher Newport University, the new musicals lab at the Ferguson Center. And they wanted to do a sort of one night only symphonic concert with the Virginia Symphony of the Violet Hour. And we were, you know, we they had kind of set that budget aside, and that was really kind of going to be happening, looking into 20, like I think spring of 2020. So we were kind of putting that together in the fall of 2019, and that seemed like kind of the next step for the show. And then you get to March of 2020 and everything shuts down, and we kind of we, everyone goes into that emergency mode. And in a, I'd say in a few weeks' time, as we got clarity on what this would look like and what this would certainly look like for our industry, I don't think anyone would have thought it would be an 18-month complete shutdown. as it were. And we went back to the Ferguson and said, well, what can we do here? Because there is an opportunity. There is, you know, like that, you know, you obviously aren't going to be, there's no producing happening on stage at the Ferguson for the near future. But, you know, is there still the budget around, you know, to do something? And we had a lot of different ideas of what this could turn into in terms of ways to do something virtually. And ultimately, through the sort of amazing collective mind, and I really want to say the urging and of Andy Einhorn, our incredible music supervisor, along with Charlie Rosen, our orchestrator, to say, what if we could get in the room safely and really do this right and actually make something that's not people in their closets, you know, with their whatever microphones they have, not trying to just record over my demos, and make something that would represent the show, certainly, but wouldn't do what we all really were born to do in real time, and certainly what this cast, you know, was absolutely born to do. And so, you know, the wheels started to get in motion with the Ferguson to sort of set up what this process would be. We learned as we started making it that what we thought it would take to produce this album was not what we had. And so there was a crowdfunding campaign to help complete the album. It took a lot longer than we ever expected in terms of how we would go from recording the vocals through into recording the orchestra. Because not only it's not like, you know, we opened the show on, you know, Sunday night, and now on Monday we're recording the album. We were still getting to, as much as we had done development for the show, when you have writers in the room and you have this genius cast, and now we're starting to hear our show the way we always imagined it, we have thoughts and we want to get it right, you know, and the clock is ticking in that studio. And so we are hearing the work actually come through, fully realized for the first time in real time, and doing everything we can in those sessions to actually move the writing forward. And so the entire post-production process was taking all of the different takes from both the cast and the orchestra and mix it in a way that moved the actual development of the show forward. It wasn't like something was frozen and locked in time and then we just captured it. There were so many micro creative decisions that then went into the show as we mixed the album. And so, you know, Eric, what was the actual, you're much better at the timeline than I am. The actual timeline of when we started with the actors to the release of the album was what again? What was that? When did we start?
We were recording with our brilliant cast, which we can't bury the lead any longer.
Please.
We must say that the cast consists of Tony Award winner Santino Fontana, Tony Award winner Brandon Uranowitz, Tony and Grammy nominee Jeremy Jordan, the former star of Mean Girls, Erica Henningsen, the current star of Hadestown, Saleha Pfeiffer. It was a brilliant group of artists, and they were all in the studio in the darkest days of the pandemic with us, each in their own isolation booth. In a way, a recording studio is actually a perfect place to gather during a pandemic because everyone has their own isolation booth. And it's a very expensive place to gather, I should say, but it's conducive towards no one getting sick. And we were there in February of 2021. This was when the vaccine was only available for healthcare workers. This was a time when you were testing every day, when there was real and legitimate fear that gathering in any group setting was going to be dangerous or fatal. And yet, that did not get in the way of artists needing to make art. And so it was February of 2021. The album came out in November of 2022. And the entirety of that period was dedicated not just by us, but by an army of people that we onboarded into the world of the Violet Hour. And the movie tells this story because you're able to see how much thoughtfulness and how many people it takes to deliver every single individual tiny moment on a cast recording. It was a long process. It was an expensive process, but not a day goes by that I question whether or not it was worth it. And I always answer, it was incredibly worth it. It is paying dividends that we are aware of now and that we will come to be aware of for the rest of our lives. And creating something that can outlive the pandemic as an activity, as a purpose to get you through the pandemic was helpful, indeed essential for our hearts and souls during that time. We had dedicated our lives to the theater, and then the plug was pulled on making theater, the thing that we built our careers on and our purpose on was eliminated from the world. And we had to find a way to fill that space. I'm so grateful for the way that we filled it and for the people who helped us do it.
It's an incredible cast. Just like, were they the ones that were going to be used in the original? If the pandemic never happened, were they the people who was going to be on stage performing it, or were they cast after once the pandemic happened and you were going to put the album together?
We created the cast for the album. We had written the show with these people in mind, certainly, in the way that you sort of have dream casting in your head as you write a musical. And it's lucky that the dream came true. Because of the pandemic, everyone was very available. There were no other jobs. And one of the nice things about this project is it was able to provide work, not just for our five cast members, but for the entire music team, the entire technical team, all of the orchestra. This provided income and an artistic opportunity for individuals for whom those things were not available, certainly available in ready supply during the pandemic. But our cast was assembled because we had the opportunity to cast whoever was around and willing to say yes. And luckily, everyone was around. And these five, gratefully, were willing to say yes.
That's awesome. Oh, yeah. Because trying to, imagine doing this in another moment in the industry, in world history, mm-hmm. To get this group organized with it, around schedules, it would have been so many compromises to try to get into the room with the cast we wanted, just around people's lives and schedules and, their work. And so to have this window really is, it's like truly singular, and the play, when we talk about what the Violet Hour is, it is this, it's the moment transitioning from day into night where the world actually like shakes you to be like, you're here, like you're present right now. It's happening right now. Don't forget that. There are things you're marching towards, but don't forget you're actually here right now. And we all were in this collective Violet Hour in our homes, waiting for the time we could emerge, the industry waiting for the time we could open those theater doors open again. And so it's this of all the shows that we were sort of poised to do something with during this time, to be day in and day out living in the themes of our show and what the Violet Hour represents. And this reminder that we're all in this passage in between something, and that we were in this collective, like global passage in between something. I don't know. There were so many of these like synergistic moments and ties to the play, to the moment that I don't know. It's those are the things that you sort of have to look up, much like what the Violator asks you to do, and say like, yeah, this is right. I am here. This is the path. Keep going, because there are just too many of those where you can't wonder if there's not some greater plan around somewhere, even if that's just a thought that helps you get through it. Right.
Yeah. Was the idea of the movie there right from the beginning, or did you just, you were recording stuff, people were recording stuff, and then you realized, I have all this material. We should put something together.
Yeah. So amazingly, the Ferguson Center, who was able to make those initial recording sessions happen, they also put in place a film crew at Hallelujah Productions, who are an amazing film production studio in Brooklyn. They came in and we had them for only one of our vocal recording days. And so that's where all of the studio footage is from that first day. And then, of course, we all have cell phones, right? And so we're taking our own little things. And, that footage actually winds up being okay. And then we're in the orchestra sessions recording with our own stuff. And then we created all these music videos. And so we have the music videos plus all of our own behind the scenes from that. And Eric, we were looking at all of this footage, and Eric was the one who set this idea in motion that if we have all of these assets, all of this archival footage, What would it take to string it together, to go back through those hours and hours of studio footage and create the narrative of what it took to do this thing? And I think had we not done it during the pandemic with all this, so much against us and so much riding on, beyond just the album, just for everyone's personal health and safety and livelihood, so much was at risk. We just thought it did make a compelling, it was worthy to go back through those hard drives and bring it all up and craft the narrative of what we did when we did it. And we were just so fortunate to have all that sort of found footage and existing footage. So yeah, but that it was definitely certainly, I think had we had the idea, the foresight at the beginning, hey, like we're going to make a movie or we're going to do a, we were so busy writing. I mean, I actually don't even, the film crew was sort of like a bit of a hindrance in a way. Like, we're trying to write, we're trying to create, we're trying to get the album right. But then they have needs, right, to like make sure they're in the right place. And so we had to stop time, often for cameras to set up. And like, we're like, we have got to go here, people. And so, those recording that day of recording, like it was like a stressor too, to have that. And so it was definitely not top of mind. We were grateful to have it. I don't know, Eric, I'll kind of pass that to you just in terms of your thinking of, I mean, I feel like, the cameras on those days, like it was amazing, but also like it was another obstacle, I would say, for sure.
Yeah, I always feel like the loudest instrument in the recording studio is always the ticking clock that says, you got to get out of here at 5 p.m. They're going to kick you out and you can't afford to pay any more to stay longer. So you have to finish everything you need to finish by then. And certainly the cameras didn't speed things along, but obviously we're incredibly grateful that we captured everything we did, that the actors were able to sit for interviews to speak about their artistic process and their characters. In a way, every work of art is the result of a lot of miracles happening. So much can go wrong, and especially in such a intensely collaborative art like musical theater, it's a multitude of miracles that yield anything. And yet, to create a cast album without the infrastructure of a production, without the infrastructure of a professional producer, when it really is just the writers trying to make the thing happen, and the generosity of crowdfunding and our institutional supporter, the Ferguson Center for the Arts, and a brilliant cast in the midst of a pandemic, it felt like the creation of the cast recording was the result of an unusual number of miracles that came to pass. And once we were on the other side of that experience, it seemed like we had endured and accomplished a story worth telling. And as a result, making the movie to pull back the curtain on how we did what we did during the pandemic, how we did not let the elimination of theater actually eliminate the creation of theater. That story was worth telling. And I'm so glad that we've just released it into the world so that not only people can learn what we did, but so people can be empowered to do their own version of it. Certainly not to copy our experience, because every act of art making is as unique as a fingerprint and you have to do it your own way. But if witnessing how we did it our way can inspire someone else to do it their way, I'd be so proud and grateful that the story and the gifts of the Violet Hour keep giving. And I look forward to hopefully hearing in the future that the studio cast album, which preceded obviously any production, and the movie that tells how it was all accomplished, how those things inspire someone else to make their art would be just incredibly gratifying.
Yeah, all artists of the future have to learn from the past and build upon what they've learned. And as you did when you were in Chicago with Bounce, right? Learning from those people who learned in turn from before them. So I just got to say congratulations on like everything. And, building during the pandemic, which you've created and it is what you did was true art. It's you guys, the artist, having to do it right and put it together yourself, and bringing everyone together. So just what you put together was fantastic and a great show as well. Everything you did, and it sounds fantastic. So
thank
congratulations
you
on that. Do you have anything that that you're working on right now that you want to promote or that you can talk about?
I mean, front of mind, certainly in the category of things we can talk about, is that the story of the Violet Hour is nowhere near over. The creation of the album and the creation of the movie are, in effect, part of a drum roll that is meant to announce the world premiere production of the Violet Hour. As wonderful as the album turned out, and we're so proud and pleased that it's been embraced by so many audience members or listeners, we should say, around the world, and as happy we are that the movie tells the story of that experience, these were not the intentions of the writing of the Violet Hour. The intention was to put it on a stage, to be able to enter the body of work that is the American musical theater catalog. And we are focused on making that happen. We want to use the movie and the album as catalysts for delivering a first-class production. And in certain ways, that's in the hands of people much richer than any of us, investors or producers in Broadway productions of musical theater. But there's also something that's in the hands of all of us, which is we can spread the word about the Violet Hour, spreading the word about the album, spreading the word about the movie, spreading the word about the songwriting has the effect of just engendering a support system, an army of people who producers will then see out there in the dark as believing in the show. And that's really what it takes to make art, is not just the artists, but the believers in that art. We're now searching for those believers, and we're so grateful that we're finding them from all over the world. The most important thing on our to-do docket is to deliver a first-class production, The Violet Hour, and we feel both confident and inspired that the things we've done so far are setting up the table to really be able to deliver that.
So where can people find more about, where can these believers go to learn about the show, listen to the show?
So you can go to theviolethourmusical.com, and that is the place where you can stream the movie. The movie is $9.99. It is cheaper than your favorite burrito. And it is, you know, an hour long journey into how we did this thing. If you love Broadway, if you love this amazing cast, if you just love beyond Broadway and loving this cast, if you just love to see how people make things, and especially making something at an impossible time, I think it's inspiring to not just theater people, but to, you know, people who believe in the human spirit and the human ability to like make something out of nothing and to do the impossible during an impossible time. So the movie is there, and then of course on all of your pick your favorite music platform, you can find the album, the Studiocast recording of the Violet Hour. Just type it and you'll find it. And on social media, our handle is Violet HR Musical, and that's where you can get a lot of fun behind the scenes. We're doing all kinds of contests and giveaways. We have some beautiful signed posters that are signed by the full cast as well as Eric and I, and we've been doing some giveaways, and we've already given out about 15 or 20 of them, and we have a few more to give out. These are very, very limited, and we're kind of being careful about when we do a giveaway, but if you follow us there, if you stream the movie, you will be first to know about a way to get one of these awesome signed posters. Am I forgetting? And then you can go to reynoldsandprice.com to learn more about our work. You can go to Will Reynolds online to learn about my work. Eric, what's your website?
It is ericpriceonline.com. And Will also, we should say, takes over social media, both in terms of delightful and hilarious, often musical theater themed videos, as well as brilliant actor focused training videos. You can check him out on Instagram at Will C. Reynolds. And I'm on Instagram much less notably, but I reluctantly show up every now and then at Eric Price NYC.
Fantastic. It was great to meet the both of you, and congratulations on the Violet Hour. And I look forward to seeing where it goes from here, and wherever happens, we are here to help promote it, and we will spread the word as far as we can to everyone.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Wonderful. Awesome. All right. We were just speaking with Will Reynolds and Eric Price, the creators of the musical The Violet Hour. You can check out their studio cast recording of that. Also, the moment to moment, the making of The Violet Hour studio cast recording of the movie. Make sure to check that out. Like I said, you learn from other people and you build and you take it from there. And what they've done is fantastic. So make sure to check out all their social medias as well as the show. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion. That is musical theater. I'm your host as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.